Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Andrew Brewer. Welcome to Rock and Roll Psychic Radio. I'm going to do something a little different this evening. I'm just having me. It's just going to be sort of my fireside chat for the next couple of hours, and I'm going to talk about some different topics. I've put out on Facebook asking for questions from people about things that they like me to talk about. I've got a few, and I'm going to address as many as I can over the next 2 hours. The first one I want to look at concerns ghosts and a paranormal. Psychics lots of times don't have a lot to do with the paranormal world. In some sense, there's a bit of an antagonistic kind of energy sometimes that happens between ghost hunters and psychics. I actually kind of like the idea of ghost hunters, and I like the idea of looking at the paranormal. Some of the TV shows I think are kind of hokey, and I think that that's unfortunate, but the same could be said for psychics as well. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my theories about ghosts and my theories about haunted places as well as haunted people. So in the past, I've been on radio shows and television shows and things, and I've been asked about haunted houses. And people will say that they're in a house that has paranormal activity. And the question invariably that I will always ask is, have you ever lived in a place before that was haunted? And almost always, the answer to that question is yes. And so here's my theory about ghosts and paranormal activity and the ways in which they work. There's latent energy everywhere. There's potential energy and imprint energy everywhere. So when we go into any place, there's a residual spiritual energy in that particular place. Some places have more than others, whether this be an energetic vortex, whether it be because there's a historical reason a lot of stuff has happened in that particular place, but for whatever reason, sometimes places have a little bit more energy than others. I mean, we might go to a big city like New York, New Orleans, someplace like that, and we see there's a vibe to that particular place. So how exactly does a ghost become ghostly? What exactly is the catalyst for the ghost to do his or her thing? And to me, that ghostly energy needs electricity. It needs a booster shot. And that booster shot is typically a human. And the human is the jetpack that starts the ghost energy. So when you look at poltergeist energy, for example, there's usually it's not that uncommon to have teenage girls going through some sort of angst-ridden period in their lives to initiate that kind of energy. So the ghost needs the electricity, and that electricity is a human. And sometimes the human needs the ghost. So not only do you have the idea that the ghost is attracted to a particular type of person because they have a certain kind of vibe that they give off, which the ghost energy feeds off of, at the same time, you also have people who are naturally attracted towards the places that are likely to be the most potentially haunted. So there's a give and take here. So not only do you have people just sort of showing up where stuff's about to happen, you find that they unconsciously do it over and over and over. So there's a reciprocal energy. When you look at, like, the very first time that I ever did anything professionally, like as a ghost hunter, I went to a church in Columbus, Ohio. It turned out that one of the people involved with this church was the brother of a good friend of mine, a woman that I worked with in the English department, and she was on our softball team. I used to be the star of the Ohio State University English department softball team. Another life, but yes, I was the shortstop that hit all the home runs. And anyway, so this woman's brother heard about me later after I left the English department and asked me to come to his church. And so I'd walk around this beautiful church, and I would get to a certain place, and I would say, I can't go beyond this. They say, oh, well, we added on. We added on in 1930 or 1940, whatever. I'd go, okay. And then I'd walk another direction and go, I can't go. I feel like I just can't. Oh, well, we added on here. You added on here. How can you even tell? So what was happening, what it seems to be what was happening, was that this memory imprint, because to me that's what the ghostly energy was a memory imprint. This memory imprint had a specific area in which she, and I believe it was a she in this case, in which she was familiar. So her memory of the location defined the parameters of where she would go. And me, trying to be in tune with, trying to find if there was a ghost and who it was, that was the way I understood the architecture of that particular church. Beautiful church. So we wander around here for a while, and I started thinking about this, and I started getting an image in my head. And I felt like the image in my head was of a woman playing the organ. And I asked, I said, well, was there an organist that had some sort of thing with anybody in the church? And it turned out there actually had been, I guess, back in the 1920s, an organist, and she'd had an affair, evidently, and it had not gone well. I said, oh, okay. Now, so is the organist the ghost, or is it just that I'm picking up just stuff? Are they related? We don't know yet. So I wandered around some more, and I asked, I said, is there a room, because I'd never been in this church, right? This was the mid-1980s, like 1988, I guess, 87, 88, somewhere there. Anyway, I asked, I said, is there a room upstairs that has filing cabinets? Turns out there is a room in this church upstairs filled with filing cabinets. And I saw in my head like sheet music. And in the sheet music, I saw a whole note, a dotted whole note at the end of this music. I couldn't see what the music was. And I thought, well, this is odd. You know, why am I seeing this? So I said, okay, is there some room upstairs with the filing cabinets? And there was. So we walk up the steps. I walk over, there's probably 30 or 40 big, tall, gray steel filing cabinets. I open the very first one that just sort of pops in my head to open. And it's filled with, as it turns out, that there are manila folders filled with sheet music. The first one I pick, and forgive the pun here, gospel truth, the first one I pick out, I look at it, I forget the name, I wish I could remember the name of the song, the name of the hymn. But I look at it, the very last note of this piece of music is a dotted whole note. And the very last line is, and I will live in thine house forever. Okay, well, that's what this woman was doing. She had come back to live in her house forever. And so she was imprinted in this particular place. So I show up, and I have a certain kind of energy. So is the energy that I am able to see her, feel her, or is it that she feels me and so shows up because I'm there? So obviously, they wouldn't have asked for a psychic to come try to find their ghost if there wasn't something going on. At the same time, the question has to arise, is the ghost there all the time, or is the ghost only there in a visible way when there is someone who is the jetpack portable battery that lights her up? I don't know the answer to that, but I suspect that it's that she showed up because I was there, and I do believe that that's true. So we look at haunted places. Sometimes, like when I lived in Los Angeles, I nicknamed Los Angeles after a few weeks, I named it Casperville, like in Casper the Ghost, right? So LA has got some whacked out energy. I love Los Angeles, but it makes me tired. It probably makes a lot of other people tired. But there are a lot of people who have shown up in LA, going to be movie stars, going to be whatever. It's very disappointing. That sort of collective disappointment has an energy. Thoughts, emotions have energy. This is an important element to look at when you're working as a psychic, right? So when I make predictions, especially economic predictions, global kinds of predictions, what I'm really doing is I'm looking at the collective emotion. I'm trying to understand what that emotion is telling me, and I'm trying then to reverse engineer what would likely cause that type of emotion on a large scale. For an example, then I'll get back to ghosts because they're related. So when I showed up again on the scene in my second incarnation as a psychic in 2007, I started talking about publicly, because I'd been doing it privately, but I wasn't a psychic, right? I was doing something else. So I started talking about it publicly that I felt it to be a huge financial problem on the horizon, and it would relate to the housing market. That because, and the reason I said that, in large measure, was because I felt that people were collectively really, 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 and I mean really, unhappy about their houses, right? So that collective energy suggested to me a pain point. That pain has a certain kind of weight to it. So the weight of that collective pain, it sort of jumps out. It's, if you listen to it, it tells you things, right? It speaks to you. So then I had the emotion, and I had sort of what I thought might be causing the emotion. And then I had to create some sort of probability model in my head as to what would make that emotion happen. Maybe housing prices go down. Maybe people have their houses foreclosed upon because they're upside down on their mortgages. Maybe that's an issue. I'm going to say that there's going to be a housing crisis. So getting back to Los Angeles and Casperville, and then getting back to ghosts. So in Los Angeles, there is this very pervasive collective energy. So it begs the question, going back to what I said initially, the ghosts need an energy pack to plug into. Well, there's a lot of, you know, very intense energy in Los Angeles, artists, actors, you know, outlaws, people trying to escape Illinois or whatever, all end up in Southern California. So there's a tremendous amount of energy to draw upon. At the same time, a lot of the people heading to LA are probably looking to escape something where they started out from, as well as create a picture that they have in their mind in this magical land of illusions called Hollywood. So we have a gigantic laboratory in which to play out this puzzle, that the ghost needs an energy to draw upon, and certain people are magnetized to places where the ghost will hang out. Los Angeles has this. Nashville has this. New Orleans has this. There are lots of places that have it. So the collective energy of their history, and usually that's a history that involves trauma and disappointment. War will certainly be traumatic and disappointing. So that history leaves like a scratch on the furniture. But we notice the scratch because we come and we have enough people looking at the scratch. And so that is the, how's the best way to put this? The ghosts need you, but you also, certain people need the ghosts. So there is a simpatico give and take. There's a happy soulmate type of relationship between the haunted and the haunting. So I hope this is making sense. And I realize this is kind of a weird way to do it because no one's actually giving me feedback on Andy, you're making no sense, or Andy, you are. So the next piece of this relates to paranormal television. I watched a show a few years ago. My roommate said, you have to watch this show with me. And I'd lived in Nashville at the time, my roommate Simone Cross. And so we're watching a show called Deep South Paranormal. And my joke, not to really diss the people on Deep South Paranormal, although I'm getting ready to do that, was that if your IQ and the number of teeth added up to be greater than 100, you couldn't be on this show. And it seemed to me that they took the people who were sort of stereotypically a certain kind of way and created a show about them. You often find this with reality TV shows, too, with psychics. There's a certain kind of energy that they try to portray. I've been approached about different reality TV shows in the past. I did an infomercial long ago, back in the 90s, on for a couple of years. And in the reality TV shows in which I've been approached, I'm almost always perceived in this kind of collective, like, you know, you know, whatever that thing they used to have on MTV was, that show where they put people in the house, that I was going to be sort of the aging stud psychic. You know, that was sort of me, the David Lee Roth, you know, psychic or whatever they thought I was. But there's an artificiality to it. So the thing that I think is complicated, and then I'm going to get off the ghost and EVP thing. The thing that I think is complicated in this is that we take something that has a beauty to it, because the paranormal is really a beautiful thing. The relationship that you have to spiritual energy, the relationship that you have to history, the relationship that you have to a ghostly presence is really a magical, aesthetically pleasing kind of relationship. But when we try to make everything fit into its own little, you know, thermometer and yardstick kind of environment, I think we lose a lot of that magic and we lose a lot of that spontaneity, the potential for growth, the potential for transformation, because much as you oftentimes will see in a ghostly environment, a haunted environment, that there is the potential for a certain amount of chaos. Chaos oftentimes is a catalyst for beautiful things to happen. And so when we try to rope off the beauty of the ghost, I realize this is the weirdest way to explain it, but when you try to rope off the beauty of the ghost, when you try to rope off the transformation of that potential energy, then I think you're taking away what it's all about to begin with. And so these shows tend to, from my way of looking at them, distort the quote-unquote reality of the paranormal by trying to make it conform to what can be recorded rather than trying to speak to it on its terms. What I always say is, if you're going to talk to ghosts, learn to speak ghost first. Again, I hope this is making some sort of sense. Now, in the context of spiritual energy and transformative energy, there's probably nothing more transformative than the interaction with another person. So now we're going to flip a little bit from the ghost to reincarnation. Excuse me. So when you look at, I've done so many different radio shows, and typically there's somebody interviewing me, and I don't sound like a totally a crazy man just talking to myself, but, you know, hey, it is what it is. So with a soulmate, from my definition, is this. A soulmate doesn't have to be Fabio with hair in the wind. It doesn't have to be Barbara Cartland speaking to us from the grave. It doesn't have to be anything that's like a romance novel. A soulmate is simply someone who shows up, who rocks your world and changes you because you have an emotional reaction to them. And as a result of the emotional reaction to the individual, then you change the way that you look at yourself. And oftentimes you will go down a different path. I met Betty Sue. I fell in love with Betty Sue. I got on the Greyhound with her and we went to Wisconsin. And I became a dairy farmer and I didn't like being a dairy farmer. So I left Betty Sue and went someplace else. And I ended up in New York. But while I was in New York, it was different because I remember being on a dairy farm in Wisconsin. Okay, so Betty Sue's your soulmate. And the reason that she's your soulmate is not only did she kind of come along and impact the way you see yourself and change the course of your life because you went off to Wisconsin to be a dairy farmer, she also set you on a specific trajectory because you might not have gone to New York because you might have been totally happy had you originally gone to Philadelphia instead of going to Wisconsin. So your reaction to the chain of events that are often set in motion by your initial reaction and connection to this soulmate energy is, in my opinion, preloaded. Okay, you have free will up to a point. I don't think you have total free will. We can debate this all day, but since nobody on the line, I guess I won't have to debate it too much. But in my opinion, there is no such thing as complete free will. You have the free will to interpret, but even that's a little subjective in that your conditioning plays a large part in the way in which you process information. Your history certainly gives you specific signposts about how you will interpret something. So in that sense, your history is already selectively pointing you in a particular way, which is limiting the freedom of your free will. But a soulmate is anybody who, because of your interaction with them, you change the way you see yourself. You change the way that you feel about people in general. Well, I never knew I could be in love until I met Betty Sue. I never knew I could really not like anybody as much as I do Betty Sue. Okay, so all these things, we have these reactions. But it's the reaction to people that defines the course of what we do. There is no growth without people. There is no way to make a prediction as a psychic without trying to gauge the ways in which other people are impacting you. There is no way that you can make sense of someone's path, their blueprint towards prosperity, their blueprint towards spiritual evolution, without having some sense of how they relate to people, but relate to them. So, again, I hope this is making sense. So if we have a soulmate, we have to look at the idea that with a soulmate, there is the potential that that soulmate has a history before they show up live in 3D in front of you. And if they do have a history related to you, there is certainly a case that can be made that that history comes along prior to this particular incarnation, which would also suggest that we live though we reincarnate, okay? Anyone that knows me knows that I am a strong proponent in the idea that there is such a thing as reincarnation. The thing that has driven my career more than all other factors has been my belief in reincarnation, at least in the possibility of reincarnation, and my desire to try to understand it, and my desire to, as much as possible, catalog how it works in my life, but how it works in theoretically so that it can be applied to everybody else's life. And I'm still working on that. I've been doing it for, you know, over 40 years. But if there are soulmates, and if there are past lives in which these soulmates have interacted with you in the past, then we have some logistical issues that we have to work out, right? The first is, if I knew you in Berlin in 1850, how come I'm running into you in Ohio in 2017? How did you get here, and how did I get here, and what are we doing here? Did someone point us here? Or did someone, or is it totally an accident? So again, no one has the answer to this. No one knows the answer to these questions. So everything that we do as psychics, and I hate to disappoint you, there is no psychic who knows all. I don't know all. Nobody else knows all either. And there is no one that understands reincarnation 100%. It's all a theory. It's all speculation. We all do the best that we can. But the idea is that there is a method to the madness of why people continue to show up over and over and over, which raises the potential for something else a lot of you may have heard in the past, a concept called soul groups. So we're going to talk a little bit about my ideas, or I'm going to talk a little bit about my ideas about soul groups, soulmates, and the ways in which those things come together, what they mean, why they come together, and how we can maximize the good of whatever that process happens to be. So, if we think of a soul group, and we think of what lots of times is referred to as a soul contract, then the next question again has to be, if there's a soul contract, who wrote it and who signed it? And what's the point of it, right? So soul contracts come about, in my belief, because we are creating a specific trajectory within our lives to accomplish certain types of things that are predetermined, preloaded, done in conjunction with other sort of spiritual counselor types of energy before we show up here. If that's true, again, everything's speculation, but if that's true, then what it says is that there is a spiritual energy external to the earth that is impacting what we do, why we do it. So this gets in all sorts of funky questions about God and multidimensionality and all sorts of things. But I'm going to err on the side of saying that, yes, there are multidimensional types of states. There are disincarnate types of energies external to the earth. We might have 1 foot on earth and 1 foot someplace else, and maybe a couple of feet we don't even know about in other planets. But before we show up, I believe that we create a specific blueprint about what we want to do. Reincarnation, if there is something that reincarnates, that thing that reincarnates is basically a soul essence that is at its bottom line, the soul essence is an emotional style. It is an emotional template. It is a mindset that we bring with us. It's impacted by our history. It's impacted by the things we've done and accomplished or haven't accomplished. It's impacted by a lot of different variables, but there's a certain basic core personality type, an emotional style, and that emotional style also brings with it a vision of who you are physically, which is why we oftentimes will see when we're trying to do matching for past lives, a very similar physical characteristic as well. Your body is impacted, of course, by your genetics, but it's also impacted as we go along by the way in which you see yourself and by the choices that you make. And the choices that you make are also reflective of how you see yourself. So we have the soul blueprint, the soul essence. We have knowing what we are about in conjunction with the spiritual counselors, which is how I think it works. Spiritual counselors that help us define the ways in which our life is going to unfold. We also have people who have contracted to show up to be the sort of the nudge, the Betty Sue's in Wisconsin, to get us to change the ways in which we do things. Now, this is a very intricate sort of song and dance about how that we get this, these soulmate pieces together at the times in which we get it together. And so within the soul contract, we may say, okay, you show up when I'm 20. And this will do this to me, but I'm going to help you. And the way I really help you the most is to really come in and be totally whack out your world and make it just total chaos. And so you think, wow, dude, chaos is not what I really want. But maybe you've got a little contract, a little clause in the fine print that says when you're 20, this person shows up, totally rocks your world in reverse, and as a result of that, throws your life into sort of a disarray, chaotic form that you have to magically somehow put back together with no resources to really do this. But in putting it back together, you develop a skill, you develop a certain style of relating to the world, you change the way you see the world, maybe you have an extra dose of cynicism or an extra dose of self-resolve or an extra dose of something, and that comes about in part by the marriage between your soul essence, personality profile, and the triggering agent of this particular soulmate. Okay, so we have the soul essence. We have the contract in place. We have the contracted players in place, the soulmate, lineup. And what is the way in which this unfolds? Now we have to bring in an additional element above and beyond genetics, and that is the concept of astrology. To me, the most important determinant of what's going to happen in your life is astrology. And astrology is a magical blueprint, provided we know how to read the magical blueprint, a magical blueprint that shows not only the ways in which you are likely to express your individuality, the ways in which you are likely to express your strengths and weaknesses. It is also a seed pod of when you will bloom and when you will wilt and when you will bloom again. There are timing mechanisms built into in very intricate, finite detail within the astrology chart, and it is our task, in some sense, as astrologers or clairvoyants, to try to unravel the mysteries hidden within the chart. So we have genetics. My mom was this way. My dad was this way. My grandfather was like this. He goes back, way back into the recesses of time. All the little spermies and the eggs get together. They have their own thing. I've got this kind of eye color. I got this kind of hair or lack of it. You know, genetics is not always good. So we have the genetics. Then we have the environment. I live in this, I live in the suburbs, but I got a bunch of hillbillies for parents, and I, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's all, we have the environment. Then we have the ways in which our picture of ourselves evolves based on the messages that we absorb. And they all go into a giant pot. But the way that we begin to see the probability that Billy will take his family dysfunction and continue it, and Tommy will rise above the family dysfunction and transmute it and do something magical with it where brother Billy is not, is shown in the astrology. I hope this is making sense. So we have the astrological picture. And so past lives are reflected in astrology. And we can see past life influences within the chart. There are a lot of places that we can see this. We also, when you look at potential matches, past life matches within a chart, what you're really looking at is there's an astrological concept called synastry. And so if you're looking at, like, even when I was a teenager, I was pretty slick because I believed in astrology and I had an ephemeris. I could sort of figure this out. This is early on in there, you know, I was like 19 years old in college, like a sophomore in college, and I figured this out. And so I would get people's birthdays. I go, oh, when were you born? Oh, yeah, well, that's interesting. You know, my birthday is in February, and how old are you? And so I would figure all this stuff out, right? And the reason I wanted to figure out when they were born was because I wanted to look at their astrology chart. And I would use that as a way to figure out potential compatibility. So the astrology is there as a signifier of energetic alignment with other people, so we can look at astrology charts and get a pretty good case if we think that you all are going to get along or not. And that's based on mathematical harmonics, and there's a certain kind of intensity that goes with that. So at the same time, just as you would do the synastry between two different people, you would also have a synastry between two different past lives. So if I look at past life potential matching, if the astrology, you can be twins and every piece of your story can match, but if you do the astrology and the astrology's got nothing in common, then you're not, that past life is not true. It's a mythology. So there is a strong harmonic relationship between you and the astrological chart. And so at the same time, there is a strong astrological affinity between you and a potential soulmate. And we can chart that out. When you look at astrology, when you're looking for a seed, trying to understand the evolutionary seed within the chart itself, what you're looking for, one of the ways you do this is through something called a progression. So a progression is, the spatial relationships between planets will manifest themselves as a time element. So if we have the planet Neptune in our natal chart and the moon in our natal chart are 37 degrees apart, we're going to build a case that at the age of 37, there is going to be an external event that's going to happen in your life that's going to help clarify in a very dramatic way the interchange between moon and Neptune. And so we can build a model looking at astrology for when certain things are likely to happen, and knowing the energy of that particular planet as it manifests in relationship to the rest of your chart, we can also build a pretty good case as to the types of things that you could do before age 37 that would help make this clarification of Moon Neptune energy a positive one, as opposed to a pop quiz that you failed and set you back. So there are rewards inherent within the chart, and there is information within the astrology chart itself that give you strategies towards maximizing the potential that's outlined within the birth chart. Again, I hope this is making sense. And I realize this is sort of a weird way to do a radio show. I tried this as an experiment. I'm not totally sure that this experiment is working, but that's okay. So trying to tie this all into a nice little bow here. Reincarnation is the sense that this essence of who we are is timeless, that it does not have a beginning, it doesn't have an end, it's sort of an infinite energetic pulse. It's a pulse point. There are schools of thought that say that all time is happening concurrently. This is hard for me to really accept, but it's certainly possible. I make predictions of things that happen in the future all the time, which begs the question, how is that possible if it hasn't already happened? Because I have to be seeing something. What exactly am I seeing? I mean, there's a lot of funky quantum mechanics, quantum physics kinds of questions that come out of precognitive types of processes. And the final thing I want to talk about, and I'm going to cut this show short. I'm just going to make it an hour instead of 2 hours. The final thing that I want to talk about this evening relates to the way in which we find our true nature of who we are. Most people are taught who they're supposed to be, what they're supposed to be, how they're supposed to go about doing it, and they are taught the limitations. More than anything, they're taught limitations about what they can't do. Now, there are physical limitations we have, but most people stop themselves from doing things because they absorb bull's doubts. And sometimes those doubts are based on faulty ways of seeing themselves. The people who are planting the seed of doubt, it's not done maliciously. It's simply that they have been given a faulty model and have accepted it and just kept going and going and going with it. Or sometimes it's done because it's designed to stop you from evolving a certain way. And in those particular cases, lots of times we see this with parents or romantic partners, the question that you have to ask yourself then is there a selfish motive by the person who is trying to make you believe this limitation is legit? The best advice I can give people is this, across the board. You learn limitations and you have the choice at every step along the way to accept those limitations or to question them and try to do something about it to prove that that limitation is not legit. One of the ways in which you can start this process is to really look at the people giving you this message, to really look at trying to understand why they might do this. And one of the things I suggest to people, and especially you see this with clients who have been abused as children, certainly sexual abuse as children, what happens with people who have been sexually abused is that their cognitive powers are distorted. And the reason that happens is because the person who initially abused them and sort of the collective family energy is such that they try to say, oh, well, but Uncle Bobby couldn't have done that. You just imagined that. Well, it certainly seemed like it happened. No, sweetie. You just imagine that. Uncle Bobby's not like that. He would never do that. I'm sure he was just playing. I'm sure. Well, it seemed like, no. We're not going to talk about it anymore. That didn't happen to you. So if you repeat that often enough, then your own experience is brought into question. If your own experience is brought into question, then your ability to perceive your own experience is brought into question, which means that your powers of perception ultimately are brought into question and distorted. And so one of the things that I suggest to people in this particular case is say, okay, imagine that there's a reality TV show being filmed across the street. And they're filming it in a house. The house has total glass. We can just watch it. We don't even have to wait for it to be on TV. We can watch it live in 3D from across the street. And if you see a little girl, an actress who's playing you, and you watch the actors and actresses that are reproducing your life from that period, whether you're 3 or 13 or whatever, you see what happens, excuse me, to that little girl or that young woman. When you watch it happen across the street, do you think that what happened to that girl, that it's fair for that girl to feel guilt about it? Do you think it's fair that she feels as if she brought it on herself, that she caused it? And people go, well, no, of course not. Okay. If it's legit for that little girl across the street not to feel guilty and not to take that with her and to recognize that something happened to her, is it legitimate for you then? Is it fair to you then? If you are coming out of a similar type of experience, for you to hold guilt yourself? And so we begin to build behavioral models as best we can to try to help people to own their power and understand that much of the time their feelings of disempowerment are reflections of inappropriate models that are planted in their head by other people who are doing it for their own self-interest. Again, I hope that makes sense. So children, especially sexual abuse victims, any kind of abuse victim as a child, they're taught these things not to help them, but to blind them to what's happened to them. And this blindness keeps going and going and going. And so from a soulmate standpoint, and I'm going to tie it all together here the best I know how. From a soulmate standpoint, then the restriction is part of the soul contract. That doesn't mean I'm down with soul contracts in this way. But it would also suggest that that is part of the journey. I didn't enjoy losing a child. I didn't enjoy that experience. I didn't enjoy a lot of the experiences that I had. But they changed me in a certain way. And had I not had that experience, disruptive though it may have been, I would not have changed from within in the ways in which I did. And so bringing all this back to my initial thought about haunted places and haunted people, sometimes people who have had negative experiences as children, their emotions are all charged up, but they don't have a way of releasing that in a consistent, straightforward manner. It's all kind of bottled up within them. That bottled up quality is the jetpack battery pack that the ghost responds to most. And because there is a tentative nature to the ways in which people process reality, if their sense of self has been distorted as children, because their parents or relatives or neighbors or whatever have tried to distort their sense of reality in order to try from someone trying to protect themselves, those children grow into teens and adults, and they are typically the ones most drawn to haunted places, and they are also the type of energy most attractive for a ghostly energy to draw upon. So it's weird, but I think it's true. So I appreciate you all hanging out with me in my little fireside chat this evening. My name once again is Andrew Brewer. You can find me on Facebook. It's facebook.com/andrew.brewer. My website is andrew-brewer.com. I hope everybody is having a happy evening. I wish you all good things, and we will see you on Wednesday at 7 o'clock Eastern, 4 o'clock Pacific with actress Monique Parents. On Thursday at 9 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock Pacific, The Psychic Chef. And everybody have a happy week, and we will see you on Wednesday. Have a good day. Bye. Yes.